You know, like these countries in Central America, they had thriving economies, they had decent governments, and a lot of them, the U.S. helped overthrow some of these governments, and now we are stuck with the results where economies have collapsed, and people left without any resources, so they are coming to the only place they know of that still has some kind of opportunity for them, namely the United States, which kind of created a situation in the first place. It's kind of like a circular thing going on. It's not a circular economy. It's sort of a circular dystopia, I guess.
We have one last caller.
One last caller. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to add, when you were talking about, gentleman was on there talking about Afghanistan, which is true. The, you know, President Biden said, take out the troops, our troops, but he didn't mention anything about the contractors that
are going to
be in there. Many, mm-hmm. many, many more contractors than troops,
mm-hmm.
and doing the same darn thing, you know. So, I just, I have such a hard time trusting much about Biden myself. We're all Bernie people, and but anyway, Bernie's working hard with him.
Hope so. Well, hope we see more of him. Anyway, you made some very good points. Too bad they're coming in the last minute of our show time.
Okay.
But thank you very.
I love your program, by the way. You're it's really informational, and that's why we give you donations.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, the place to call for giving donations. 503-231-8187, or go online to the KABU webpage, and I think you will see a little button that
information
says donate.
About KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kabu.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hello, listeners. It's KABU's Spring Membership Drive and your cue to show your support for community-supported, volunteer-powered, independent radio. Please become a monthly sustaining member or make a one-time donation. Just go to kboo.fm/give. And thank you for your support. And now, Radio Zine. Welcome to Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. CAHOOTS, or Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets, is a 24/7 mobile crisis intervention program that serves the cities of Eugene and Springfield, Oregon, as an alternative to police response for nonviolent crises. My guest is Brenton Gicker, a registered nurse and emergency medical technician who has worked for CAHOOTS since 2008. Welcome, Brenton.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Brenton, CAHOOTS is a 24/7 constant patrolling mobile service. Give a little background about CAHOOTS and Whitebird Clinic in Eugene.
So, CAHOOTS was formed in 1989. So, the program, in some form, has actually been around for more than 30 years. So CAHOOTS is a program of Whitebird Clinic. Whitebird Clinic is the parent agency. Whitebird Clinic operates probably a dozen or more programs, different types of programs. They have a medical clinic, a dental clinic, a counseling program, a crisis hotline, an outpatient drug and alcohol treatment clinic, and so forth. So Whitebird Clinic is a kind of a countercultural social service that has existed for about 40 years. And basically how CAHOOTS got off the ground was that, you know, the police and the fire department you know, are constantly responding to these calls involving people having mental health problems, people having intoxication problems, people having problems related to poverty and homelessness. And they're often not the right response to those calls. And so the idea with CAHOOTS was, well, you know, we have the police, you know, theoretically the police respond to crimes and the fire department responds to, you know, medical emergencies and fires and accidents. Well, what about a different kind of response to handle these other types of calls, you know, involving people having problems that are primarily related to mental illness or substance dependency or homelessness? And so CAHOOTS was intended to be a sort of alternative to the 911 system for different types of problems, and also an auxiliary to it, meaning that, you know, there are different types of problems that maybe do need a police response or a fire department response, but there's also the need for a different kind of response.
And it covers Eugene and Springfield, Oregon, is that correct?
Correct. So CAHOOTS has existed in Eugene in some form since 1989. The Springfield program is much newer. That started in 2015. So we've been working in Eugene for more than 30 years, and we've been working in Springfield for about, you know, 6 years.
And where does the funding come from?
The funding for the CAHOOTS program in Eugene primarily comes from the city. So it's basically public safety money. So part of the budget for 911 services basically gets carved out for CAHOOTS. In Springfield, it's a little more complicated, I think, because it started in Springfield as there was a federal grant to fund mobile mental health services that was awarded to Lane County. So it was federal money that was temporary. And now they're working out some kind of arrangement where the city of Springfield and the county, you know, share the cost or something like that.
Brenton, about you, now you are a registered nurse and an EMT, an emergency medical technician, and you have worked for CAHOOTS for quite a long time. So what is your background and training? Talk a little bit about your work with CAHOOTS.
So I've worked on CAHOOTS since 2008, so I'm going on 13 years. I've worked for Whitebird Clinic for about 15 years, I believe. I think I started in like 2004, 2005, so probably, you know, more than 15 years. So I worked for other Whitebird programs before I worked on CAHOOTS, mostly in a kind of like a reception desk worker kind of role. I volunteered for different community groups before I worked for CAHOOTS. And that was kind of what got my foot in the door. But I really, when I started out, I really didn't have a lot of experience. But I got a lot of experience on the job and then got, you know, more, you know, different kinds of training down the road.
And what is the required training? Are you constantly having trainings to keep up with programs, techniques?
Yeah. So on CAHOOTS, there's two roles. You have a medic role and a mental health role. And, you know, obviously, you know, a lot of the calls we respond to don't really fit neatly into either category, and everybody ends up doing a little bit of everything. But and a lot of people are kind of cross-trained to work in either capacity. But the mental health worker role is much more like loosely defined. There are people that are licensed clinical social workers or that kind of thing that have worked on CAHOOTS, but there's also people that don't have any kind of, you know, degree or license that are just, you know, have field experience and, you know, and on the job training. With the medic role, you have to have to practice any kind of medicine, you have to have some kind of license. So it's a little more clearly defined, you know. So on CAHOOTS, you know, you have people that have whatever level of EMT training or nursing training, and that's more a little more like streamlined. But a lot of people, like, I mean, like myself, I didn't have, at the time when I started on CAHOOTS, I didn't have a college degree. I had some limited field experience. And I basically went through a lot of, you know, on-the-job training to learn the ropes.
Is that still occurring, on-the-job training?
Yeah, that's primarily how we train people. I mean, we, you know, things like, you know, different kinds of degrees and so forth, you know, that can be helpful. But what we really value is, you know, relevant field experience and relevant life experience that translates to the work.
Who makes up the team on a daily basis when you go out on these calls?
So when I started in 2008, I remember the password we had for our like work computers was 15 freaks, because there was approximately 15 of us. Now there's about 40 of us. So, you know, we've, you know, more than quadrupled in the time that I've been around. So we, again, we have the medics, we have the crisis workers, and then we have people that do both things. And we have a, you know, a broad variety of backgrounds. Our shifts are usually 12 hours. Sometimes some people prefer to work 6-hour shifts. Occasionally we get roped into working 18-hour shifts, but usually most people work 12-hour shifts.
Do you use peers and volunteers?
We're entirely paid staff. I don't know that. I mean, it's definitely, it's a labor of love. I mean, people definitely, you know, forfeit doing more lucrative things because they like working on Kahoots. But I think maybe, you know, a volunteer-based program could work. You know, obviously there's, you know, fire departments that are primarily staffed by volunteers, but there's also, you know, would be a lot of problems with that too. So we're entirely paid staff.
And what is the attire? Do you wear a uniform? Do you carry weapons?
We absolutely do not carry weapons, except, you know, perhaps in the sense that, you know, some of our, you know, medical equipment could be, you know, perceived as a weapon or something. But we are technically an unarmed service, and our attire is what I would call kind of like casual professional. We wear things that say Kahoots. You know, we have radios. We, you know, most of us wear, you know, a certain amount of, you know, gear, but it's not totally standardized, and it's pretty casual in many ways, because we, you know, we want to be able to identify ourselves and we want to look professional, but we also want to look, you know, approachable and personable and, you know, not intimidating.
How is Kahoots integrated into public safety?
So we are, we're dispatched by police dispatchers in Eugene and Springfield. So we carry police radios, we're on police channels. And so basically we're kind of a tier of the public safety system in both cities. So people can, you can basically call. The proper way to call us is through the non-emergency number for the Eugene or Springfield police. We're not technically an emergency service. We don't respond to calls with lights and sirens, that kind of thing. But you know, you can reach us through 911. It's all the same people. Things are a little bit different in these towns, because in Springfield, they have their own dispatch. In Eugene, it's a much bigger dispatch system, because they dispatch not only the Eugene police, but they dispatch the fire department and emergency medical services for most of the area. So in Eugene, we're dispatched by the people who dispatch police, fire, and ambulance services for most of the county. In Springfield, we're just dispatched by the Springfield Police Department. But either way, you can reach us through calling 911, but theoretically, the right way to call us is through the non-emergency line. But we carry police radios, and we're dispatched, you know, on police channels.
Now, are calls, can they be self-dispatched? Can people call Kahoots, or does it have to go through the police dispatch?
So the majority of our calls, you know, how most of them come in is that, you know, somebody is either having a problem, or somebody they know is having a problem, or they see somebody having a problem, and they call the non-emergency line or 911 in some cases and say, hey, this thing is going on, or I'm having this issue, or, you know, my partner or my kid or my sister or whoever, you know, I want assistance from Kahoots, or, you know, I think this person, you know, would benefit from Kahoots assistance. That's how most of our calls come in, is people, you know, requesting us through the police lines. And then those calls are relayed to us by the dispatchers. We spend so much time in the community that we naturally encounter things all the time. So, you know, we might be driving down the street and we see an accident, we see somebody fall, we see a fight, we see you know, somebody waves their hands at us, gets our attention. You know, so we, just by virtue of being in the community as much as we are, end up self-dispatching to a certain amount of calls. But, you know, if I work a 12-hour shift, I'll probably respond to somewhere between 18 and 25 calls. Maybe two or three of those are self-dispatched, like maybe you know, we take somebody to the detox center and while we're there, they're like, hey, there's this guy who like needs to go to the hospital. We take him to the hospital. Or, you know, we're dropping somebody off at the hospital and the staff say, hey, this guy needs to go to the shelter. Can you take him to the shelter? Or, you know, or we're driving down the street and we see somebody, you know, sleeping partly in the road and we stop to check on them, that kind of thing.
So they're not all mental health crisis or intoxicated people. What other types of services or how else do you serve people on the streets in Eugene and Springfield?
Well, a lot of our calls, I mean, like probably about, you know, half, maybe 60% of our calls involve the homeless population, but a lot of them don't. A lot of our calls involve people that are, you know, that are housed, that maybe, yeah, suffer from mental illness or addiction or some other affliction, or just are in a crisis for some reason. But so we handle a fair amount of non-emergency medical calls that don't really, you know, neatly fit into the, you know, EMS kind of category, calls that really, you know, maybe don't require ambulance type response or just aren't helped by that. We do a lot of random things, or I don't know if random is the right word. We do a lot of, there's a lot of tasks that are traditionally handled by the police that just don't need to be handled by the police. So welfare checks, that's one example, or death notifications, that's another example. So there's these roles that the police, you know, play in most cities that, you know, that don't necessarily, you know, that don't require a law enforcement response. So we handle a number of, a variety of police calls that are not law enforcement oriented.
When you encounter a person who is in a psychological crisis, describe the behaviors.
So I don't want to get too formulaic, but I mean, it can be any number of things. I mean, you see people, I mean, we encounter people who are, you know, who are catatonic, meaning they're basically, you know, staring into space. They're, you know, awake, but they're kind of unresponsive, sort of, you know, checked out. You know, you have people that are acutely manic or psychotic, whether it's organically occurring from, you know, bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, or whether it's drug induced, people who are hyperkinetic, people that are so their, you know, their minds are racing so fast they can't, you know, form like a straight sentence, people that are paranoid and delusional, people that think people are after them, think that, you know, a chip has been planted in them, or think that, you know, the Hell's Angels are after them. I mean, it's a, or you have people that are just, you know, crippled by depression or anxiety, you know, related to, you know, real life stressors. I mean, it can look a lot of different ways.
Brenton, how do you know when a person is symptomatic due to a mental illness or is suffering from drug abuse? How do you tell the difference?
You can't necessarily. I mean, sometimes you can. I mean, we have the luxury of being familiar with a lot of the people we see. So, you know, a lot of the people we deal with, we have a pre-existing relationship with them. And so we kind of know what their issues are. So there are people that I know that I encountered them. I know they're not having a diabetic emergency. I know they're not intoxicated. I know they're not high on meth. I know that they're schizophrenic and then presents itself a certain way. There are other people who I, you know, where it's the opposite. I know that they don't necessarily suffer from a severe and persistent mental illness, but they have a methamphetamine problem or a, you know, a drug problem, and that's, you know, where their symptoms are coming from. But then there's a lot of people, I mean, like just last night I was working at the hospital and there was a girl that was brought in who, like, everybody just assumed she was high on meth. I didn't really think so because I had dealt with her before, and I was like, you know, she's like this when she's sober, you know, and everybody was baffled that she wasn't high on meth. So, you know, sometimes you can't always know. With us, it doesn't really matter. You know, I mean, we're going to probably proceed the same way regardless. You know, if we find somebody on the side of the road who's been baking in the sun and their heart's beating fast and they're not making any sense and so forth, we're probably going to take them to the hospital. It doesn't really matter to us if they're, you know, if their problem is, you know, drug induced or if it's medical or if it's psychiatric, we're going to treat them the same regardless. Sometimes you can get to the bottom of things. You know, I mean, I remember being on a call at Walmart years ago. We got a call that was came in as a intoxicated person stumbling around Walmart. And so we go and we find this girl. She's a, you know, young, probably, you know, early 20s, black woman. And she's well-kept. She looks, you know, young and healthy. And I just knew, just looking at her, she just had this glossed over look on her face. And I was like, are you a diabetic? And she was like, yeah. And so, you know, she had taken her insulin and then played soccer all day. And her blood sugar plummeted, you know, and then she went to the store to get food and was just, you know, staggering all over the place and falling down and stuff. And, you know, and came in as a drunk person. She wasn't drunk. She was hypoglycemic. So in cases like that, you know, you have an easily identifiable cause and a, you know, an easy fix. But that's not, you know, most cases.
And what about people who lack insight about their mental illness, but they clearly need help? Describe how you approach these folks and how you help.
Well, I mean, just like any other situation, I mean, you have to, you know, in most cases, people have a right to refuse care. So it really comes down to, you know, is this person a danger to themselves or others? Are they unable to take care of themselves? You know, can we justify walking away from this person or letting them walk away from us? Most of the time, the answer is yes. Sometimes it's not. I mean, sometimes you encounter people that, you know, it's usually the problem is not that somebody is really actively trying to hurt themselves or someone else. Usually the problem is more somebody is so impaired, you know, from mental illness or from, you know, whatever condition that, you know, they're really just not able to take care of themselves or they're in danger for other reasons. Like they're, you know, they're exposed to the elements, they're walking in traffic, they're neglecting themselves, their hygiene is atrocious, that kind of thing. And so, you know, any city in this country, you know, you're talking about, you know, thousands of people that are in these kinds of scenarios, you know, so you can't invest, you know, hours and hours of time in all of them. But, you know, if you encounter situations where, you know, you really feel like, yeah, this person is not fit to just be, you know, left where they're at, then you know, are compelled to try to, you know, get them care. And in most cases, or in a lot of cases anyway, I mean, if you know, are really worried about somebody, you can, you know, compel them to get care or, you know, facilitate that in some way. But sometimes you can't. I mean, sometimes you walk away from situations that you really don't want to, that you really don't feel good about.
Do you recall an incident where someone really needed help and you had to be real creative to get them the help they needed?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, I think that's in a lot of ways like what's kind of the strength of Cahoots is the ability to be creative and to be flexible and to do unconventional things. So yeah, I'm not above giving people cigarettes. I'm not above, you know, yeah, doing all sorts of, you know, weird things if that will get a, you know, desired outcome.
Give some examples of the de-escalation techniques that you use.
You know, it's a very finessed kind of thing. It's a lot to get into. I don't want to elaborate on that too much because, again, I don't want to be real, like, formulaic. But I think, you know, I was taught a real kind of basic recipe when I started. And that was kind of like introduce yourself to somebody, approach them in a kind of, you know, casual, non-threatening, informal kind of way. Build rapport, explore who they are, what's going on with them, what their needs are, and then problem solve. And that's very simplistic, but I think has, you know, basically been my approach all along, and I think usually works really well.
And Brenton, so what about when they are harming themselves? Say you walk into a situation and you get there and you find that they have a knife, or they're about to harm themselves or someone else. How do you handle that situation?
I mean, I think it's fairly common for us to, I mean, it's very common for us to deal with people that are, you know, involved in some kind of self-injurious behavior. Usually our presence and our requests that, you know, somebody, whether it's, you know, stop banging your head against the wall or put the knife down or whatever, most of the time that gets respected. But there are times, yeah, when we, you know, somebody is completely out of control and we can't safely halt that. And we, request assistance from the police or the fire department, but it's really pretty uncommon.
So how do you request police presence at that point?
So the last time I requested the police, I mean, most of the time, you know, the police request us for things. We don't request them for things very often. I mean, that's how it should be. That's kind of the whole point. But the last time I requested the police was a week or two ago. This guy showed up at a shelter. He wasn't staying there. He was extremely inebriated. He was really abusive to everybody, calling everybody every horrible name you can think of. And so we tried to get him to go to Buckley House with us, which is the sobering and detox center here. And he wasn't interested. Every time we tried to persuade him to work with us, you know, he's getting up in my face and threatening to kick my ass and all this kind of stuff. Why our hands were tied is that this guy, I mean, he didn't want anything from us. He was being horrible to everybody, but he couldn't just walk away. You know, we begged him, all right, if you don't want anything from us, just walk away. Just, you know, please just go sleep under the tree over there, whatever. He was too drunk to do that. So he'd walk like 10 feet and fall down. You know, and so after like 45 minutes of this, we were like, enough, you know, like this guy, he's not able to care for himself. He's too drunk, but he's not willing to engage with services. So, and we can't just leave him here, you know, so we ended up calling the police. And which is, you know, often feels very counterintuitive to us, but there's some situations where it's like, we can't spend our whole night, you know, begging this guy to make good choices. Like, and we can't just, you know, we can't let him walk into traffic, and we can't just, you know, leave him at this place where he's, you know, being disruptive. So, you know, usually when we call the police, I think it's a situation like that. It's not some really super intense, scary situation or something. It's just like a, this person isn't cooperating with us, but we really can't justify just leaving them here.
What are some other instances in which you feel a need to call the police?
I think like situations where you need the police, they kind of break down into like legal categories and safety categories, and then they kind of overlap, because there are situations like, say, we get sent to check on an elderly woman who missed her dialysis appointment, and her mail's piling up and her newspapers are piling up and her lights have been on for days and we can hear her dog barking and we're pretty sure she's dead inside, but we can't just like kick the door in and go see if she's dead, you know. So in that kind of situation, we would need to call the police and be like, hey, like, we're pretty sure this woman's not all right. And they're the ones that have the legal authority to like go in the house to force an entry into the house. So there are those types of scenarios. And then the other kind of scenario, I mean, we do have situations where somebody, we witness an assault or somebody attacks one of us or whatever, but that's not typical. I think a more common scenario is like, yeah, somebody's totally psychotic, somebody's totally, you know, high on meth and they're running in traffic and we can't compel them to work with us. And it's just like, we need somebody to come in and contain the person, you know. Those are the more common scenarios when we need the police.
So are the police still arresting people in Eugene and Springfield, people with mental health challenges who are committing misdemeanor crimes like urinating in public or loitering? Or are you called in those situations?
I mean, it's both. I mean, usually, you know, if we call the police for something, it's, you know, it's rarely, just to clarify, you know, it's not usually our intention to get the person arrested. You know, though, once you kind of hand things over to them, you know, it is kind of at their discretion whether they're going to arrest somebody or whether they're going to take them to the hospital or to the sobering station. But, you know, usually when we call them, it's because we're concerned about somebody's, you know, safety and we're, and, you know, not, you know, having success with them. As far as types of situations that you mentioned, you know, I think the police, kind of like the fire department, I mean, are in kind of a hard spot because they're, you know, they're bombarded with all these calls. And what is the answer to them? You know, the police know taking these people to jail for these things really isn't solving anything. Just like the fire department knows taking a lot of these people to the hospital isn't really solving anything. But they're in a situation where they're kind of like, you know, required to do something, but what they can do, you know, maybe doesn't feel very good or isn't, you know, what's needed. But that's, you know, unfortunately where we're at. So yeah, as far as a lot of the kind of like public nuisance kind of calls and stuff, you know, it can go either way. I mean, I feel like the police have really moved away from arresting people for those kinds of things. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Sometimes there's a better option, but I feel like it's one of these situations where, you know, the mental illness and substance abuse and homelessness are these problems that have been neglected for so long that now we're in this crisis, kind of like the environment, you know, we've trashed the environment for so long. Now we're in this situation. Like, what do we even do about it? Like, how do we even like remedy this now? That's how I feel about the social situation. Like, we've just let it get to such a bad point that nobody really knows what to do.
And what procedure do you use, Brenton, when some people are just so traumatized by the sight of an armed uniform officer. What do you do in those situations?
I mean, sometimes people mistake us for the police, or sometimes, you know, we show up to calls with the police and people just, you know, don't separate us in their minds. Sometimes once people, because a lot of people here know, you know, what CAHOOTS is. So a lot of times, you know, if you clarify who you are, people, you know, relax. Sometimes, you know, you have like a window of time where, you know, maybe somebody's really, you know, panicking and, you know, gaining their, you know, trust or cooperation really depends on you, like getting through to them that, like, look, we're not the police. We're not here to punish you. You're not trouble, that kind of thing. So, I mean, you find ways to penetrate that. Yeah. And the thing is that, I mean, I think, you know, the public, most of the public, including, you know, people that suffer from mental health problems, I wouldn't say, you know, most people are not against the police per se, but a lot of people are uneasy around the police, even if they're law abiding citizens or whatever. You know, the presence of the police, they associate the police with either, you know, they're in trouble or something bad has happened, and it makes them alarmed, you know, and it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with their, you know, their attitude about the police in general. It's just that, like, the presence of the police is anxiety inducing to a lot of people.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Karen James, and I'm speaking with Brenton Gicker, a registered nurse and emergency medical technician, about his work with CAHOOTS in Eugene, Oregon. I also want to remind our listeners that it is KBOO's spring membership drive. If you are tuned in because you feel this program is informative and relevant, please show your support for independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio by becoming a monthly sustaining member or make a one-time donation. Just go to kboo.fm/give right now. Thank you for listening. Thank you for giving. And now, back to the show. So, Brenton, in light of the continued news about police shootings, have you ever witnessed excessive force or physical harm or over criminalization by the police?
You know, people are gonna think I'm like a sellout or something for saying this, but you know, honestly, I deal with the police all the time, and mostly I see them treat people really decently. But I think, you know, the Eugene police, they have their own history and they've had their own, you know, issues and internal processes and stuff. And I think the Eugene Police Department that exists today, I think, is like actually pretty like humanitarian and progressive, honestly. And I, you know, I deal with situations all the time and I have so many, you know, frustrations and see so many things that are upsetting. And, but most of the time, it's really not the cops that I'm frustrated with, to be honest. But, you know, there are people on the CAHOOTS team that, have definitely, you know, seen things that made them uncomfortable. I mean, I've definitely encountered situations over the years. I've never encountered a situation working on CAHOOTS where I felt like the police like brutalized somebody or something like that. But there's been plenty of situations where I felt like maybe, you know, the person should have gone to the hospital instead of jail, or, you know, the police should have, you know, given us the opportunity to engage with the person and they didn't, that kind of thing. But so yeah, I mean, like, there are situations that I think it could have been handled better.
So, Brenton, current events that we have seen on TV, shootings, killings of people, for example, someone that was stopped and found to have warrants out for his arrest, was shot by the police, ended up dead. Another young girl with a knife ended up dead. Did you see any opportunities for a CAHOOTS type of program or de-escalation that could have been helpful in those situations?
Well, a lot of these discussions were kind of talking about like a couple of different things, because, you know, like the George Floyd situation, for example, has, you know, little, if anything, to do with mental illness, in my opinion. You know, I mean, that wasn't a situation where, you know, the police were sent to like a call with a mentally ill person and then it went haywire. That situation has more to do with just patterns of policing in this country that are bad and that need to change. But you know, that wasn't a situation where, you know, oh, like Kahoot should have been called or something. You know, it's a kind of in a totally different category in my mind. So I think, yeah, I think that there's going to be an overhaul of police departments in this country because of recent events. And, you know, and again, it's, you know, to me, I'm trying to address this like in a nuanced way, because, you know, to be honest, like I see the police, like I said, treat people decently every day, often more decently than I see, you know, staff at the hospital or some other place treat people, you know. So it would be dishonest for me to, you know, portray them as, you know, just these thugs or something, because I don't, that's not my experience. At the same time, on the other hand, I think absolutely every single day in this country, somebody loses their life for no good reason because they had the misfortune of encountering the police. And so that's the other side of it, that, yeah, absolutely. There are, yeah, people losing their lives for reasons that are totally preventable.
Should the police be involved with these types of calls, in your opinion, at all? I mean, we have the crisis intervention training where they learn de-escalation techniques. But in your opinion, is this enough training?
I mean, for me, like, you know, I've done this for a long time now. Like, so what my comfort level is it's pretty high. You know, I'm comfortable with a lot of things. I'm comfortable into going into a lot of situations without the police. I'm not trying to sound, I don't know, macho or something, but it's just like, I'm comfortable with a pretty high acuity level, but a lot of people aren't, and that's reasonable. You know, if you talk about like the fire department, for example, they won't go respond to a lot of calls without the police. So, you know, you could have a heroin overdose in the park or whatever. The fire department, you know, they have protocols built in that are like, because of the safety concerns we have, we're not going to respond to this without the police. So it's just something that needs to be taken into account, is that, you know, not all of this is police driven necessarily. I mean, there are, you know, programs, whether it's, you know, EMS programs, crisis intervention programs, that want a police response because of their safety concerns. So I guess, you know, the police are always going to be needed in some situations, I think. But, you know, I would like to see, you know, CAHOOTS type programs, you know, take a bigger, you know, kind of bite out of that cake, so to speak, like that we could, you know, make a bigger dent in it, that, you know, we could handle more things without the presence of the police.
And what other types of alternative practices for creating community safety would you support?
Well, it's a hard question, because there are things getting off the ground all over the country right now that are really positive. They're all going to look different ways based on, you know, where they're coming together. There are some people that favor something that pretty closely resembles CAHOOTS. There are people that favor social worker teams, you know, going, you know, kind of hand in hand with the police to calls. There's you know, there's things like community paramedicine programs where, you know, like some branch of the fire department is kind of basically case managing people that are, you know, frequent users of the 911 system. And there's all these different kinds of things that are sprouting up that I think are good and, you know, could kind of have pieces of the puzzle.
And Brendan, what do you wish the police did know about de-escalation techniques?
Well, you know, something that comes to mind, I don't know if this is answering your question exactly, but the former chief of police here, guy who was the chief of police for a number of years, his name is Pete Kearns. I remember he got an award from NAMI one year, the National Alliance for Mental Illness, and CAHOOTS got an award at the same event. And I attended, and the police chief, he was the chief at the time, he's now retired, told the story about CAHOOTS and how, you know, when CAHOOTS started, you know, in the late 80s, and he was a, you know, just a patrol officer or whatever at the time. He said the first time he responded to a call with CAHOOTS, he said to himself, "Why the hell would we want anything to do with these people?" And he said, but then it only took, you know, going on, you know, two or three calls with them to be like, "Oh, now I understand why." And so I guess I think, you know, as far as what the police should do, I don't feel really inclined to talk about that, but I think what's important for them to, I think police agencies to know about CAHOOTS, and what I think they should buy into it, is that we can make their job easier. We can save them lawsuits, we can save them humiliation, we can save them, just prevent them from having to deal with all sorts of hard situations, that can be really a situation that really benefits everybody.
But CAHOOTS also saves the public safety department, the police, law enforcement in the area a lot of money.
Yeah, well, you think about it. I mean, I was on a call one time. This call, it was with the fire department. I mean, they got sent to check on this like drunk guy that was sleeping on the sidewalk, a guy we dealt with all the time. And so we showed up and said, hey, you know, we'll deal with this or whatever. And they're like, you got this? Cause there's a, you know, there's a cardiac arrest like two blocks away, you know? And so, you know, and that's kind of an extreme example, but it was literally like, you know, the closest like EMS agency was like basically just scraping this drunk guy off the sidewalk. He really didn't have any kind of emergency going on. And meanwhile, there's like a real emergency, like just down the street. So that's the kind of situation where we're alleviating the emergency response so that they can respond to an emergency, you know, getting the client what they need and saving taxpayer dollars. I mean, having a couple of CAHOOTS people take, you know, some guy to the drunk tank is a lot cheaper than, you know, sending, you know, eight firefighters or whatever to take the guy to the emergency room. There's a lot of situations, whether it's like suicidal people, certain types of drug overdoses, intoxicated people, family disputes. There's all these situations where calls that would get handled by some would get this mega response from the police or EMS, you know, which are really expensive services that are instead handled by CAHOOTS. So yeah, that is often, you know, the more productive, the more appropriate kind of response, and it's the more fiscally responsible response.
We're seeing these CAHOOTS types of programs launching all over the country, as you said, but these programs are only as good as the community services, supports, and programs. So what is available in Eugene and Springfield for people that you encounter who you are trying to help?
Yeah, and I wish I could be more positive because, you know, it's funny because with the, you often hear things like, oh, there's so many homeless people in Eugene because of all the service, all the great services. And I'm like, what great services? Tell me about them. I'd like to know about them. Cause I mean, the situation here, it's like we often, you know, if we want to get somebody into detox or, you know, get somebody psychiatric treatment or whatever, it's, I mean, it's often like pulling teeth, or sometimes we have to send people, you know, make arrangements for somebody to go to Cedar Hills or, you know, leave the area or whatever, you know. So I mean, the resources here, there's some really good ones, don't get me wrong, but you know, the pandemic obviously hampered services in a lot of ways. But even before that, I mean, 10 years ago when I worked on CAHOOTS, maybe if I worked a 12-hour shift, we might get maybe one call that's like a woman shows up at the mission and wants to stay there, but she can't pass their drug test. So they call us to try to find some other arrangements for her or something. Now there's like 10 of those calls every day. I mean, the services are really, they're really strapped. And so there are some good ones. There are some programs that I, you know, I love, but, you know, the social service network here is really pretty limited, and it's making it harder for us to do our jobs, you know?
So, and once you do encounter someone and refer them to a service, do you see those same people back out on the streets?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on a day, you know, a day-to-day basis. Because again, you know, we see people, you know, I might encounter somebody who's, you know, in a bad situation for some reason, and we see them, we have an intervention with them, and we never see them again, and they're all right. But then there, you know, there are more people though that suffer from conditions that are chronic and that we are going to see over and over again. I mean, there's people that I see on CAHOOTS that I've dealt with the entire time I've worked on CAHOOTS. There's people we see that we've seen the entire history of the program, you know, and sometimes they're doing okay and sometimes they're not doing okay, and you know, we, you know, try to, you know, help them manage. But yeah, I mean, there's plenty of people, you know, we see them, we do damage control, we try to limit what harm they're doing to themselves or to people around them, you know, when we try to create opportunities for them. But some people that we see a lot of the same people over and over again, and that's just the nature of the work, you know, and some people get better and some people don't, and some people are good some of the time. And
it sounds like a lot of your work is knowing the community and knowing the people who live in Eugene and Springfield. And sometimes it just could be, as you said, a welfare check. Knowing that person might be experiencing crisis, be symptomatic, having a difficult time, and you are available, where the police or even the mental health providers or the case managers don't have the time to do that. Really, there's no service that does that.
Yeah, we're kind of, you know, we are sort of a backup plan. You know, if you call Lane County Mental Health, if you call Women's Space, if you call, you know, these different agencies in the community after hours, their voice messages, you know, instruct people, you know, if you're calling after hours and you're in some kind of crisis, call CAHOOTS, you know, because that might be the only resource that's really available.
There's still such a huge stigma around addiction and mental illness. And I can only imagine, Brenton, that driving around in your communities, just seeing your trucks with CAHOOTS written on them, how do you think CAHOOTS is helping the community's perception of people with mental illness and addiction?
I think we're a pretty, you know, loved institution. And, you know, people are proud that, you know, CAHOOTS, you know, came from this town. And I think people also recognize these problems are enormous and that they affect all types of people. I think it's kind of fun because sometimes something will happen, like a woman a while back, totally normal, I hate that word, but like, you know, totally like, you know, high functioning, ordinary person who, I forget what her condition was, maybe she had MS or something like that. She had some kind of specialized bicycle that she rode all over town. It was, you know, designed by some, you know, group that designs bikes for disabled people. And she had this really cool, like, specialized bike, and it broke down on the bike path. And so we end up getting called to, like, find this woman on the bike path. She called for help because it's like she was riding her bike home and her bike broke down and she didn't have a way to get home. And she's, like, you know, the member of some, like, prominent local organization. You got to say that you got a ride from CAHOOTS, you know, like it's kind of like a novelty thing, you know, like, you know, you can say, yeah, I've been in the CAHOOTS band.
Well, I can't imagine that it's not helping break down the stigma of these illnesses, seeing the van driving around and knowing that this is a part of the community. I think it's wonderful. So the future of CAHOOTS, where does CAHOOTS go from here?
I mean, obviously, like, there's kind of similar programs sprouting all over the country. They're all going to be quite an endeavor and an experiment because it's, you know, it is, it's challenging to find a seat at the table, you know, when you are, what you're doing is so non-traditional, so unconventional in the world of, you know, police and fire and, you know, these kind of top-down sort of militaristic organizations, you know, I mean, but, you know, figuring out how to, you know, integrate yourself into them, that, you know, is, and figuring out, you know, what you can, what is realistic for you to handle and where you can really insert yourselves and how you can be effective. You know, that's a process. That's one we're still constantly, you know, trying to figure out, you know, what do we do? What don't we do? Here, I'm not super, feeling super ambitious or anything. I mean, I would like just in the next couple of years for us to add some shifts again, like take a bigger bite out of the, you know, public safety call volume, but really kind of grow in some incremental ways and just kind of solidify the program more.
So are you saying that CAHOOTS is not totally accepted by these other departments in public safety?
I'm not saying that. I mean, like our relationship with them here is very good. But I think that took a long time, too. I can only imagine, I mean, in the 80s, I mean, just like referencing what Pete Kearns had to say, you know, like, why the hell would we want anything to do with these people? I mean, I'm sure it took a long time for CAHOOTS to be valued or respected or to be utilized. And other, you know, people are going to have to go through that process, you know, of demonstrating that they're, yeah, like this can work, this can be helpful, like you should, you know, support this.
So was it back in the 80s that you helped defund the police in Eugene or reallocate the funds from public safety to CAHOOTS?
I mean, in a sense, it's money that the money that paid to get CAHOOTS off the ground, yeah, would have gone to the police in some fashion otherwise. Though I don't think it necessarily needs to be framed that way, because I think that again, I think it's something that can be kind of beneficial to everybody.
I can only imagine the meetings and the conversations in the 1980s around starting this program. Mm-hmm. Was there a lot of resistance in the beginning?
You know, I wasn't around. I was a little kid, but I've heard some stories. But again, I mean, I think because my understanding is that partly what happened was that the Whitebird crisis hotline. They would sometimes, you know, they would get a call from somebody saying they were going to kill themselves or whatever. And sometimes they would, you know, respond in person to some of those calls. And so then, you know, there was some, you know, informal kind of interactions with the police that way, and to where the, you know, the police started thinking, oh, well, this is, you know, sometimes this is helpful. Like, you know, this person's willing to talk to these people, but not us. We can resolve a situation that way, you know? So, and then in cahoots was kind of formalizing some of that.
And I'm sure you've heard of Portland Street Response, and it is Portland's own cahoots. They just launched their program. So do you have any advice for Portland's new Portland Street Response program?
You know, obviously they're operating in a more metropolitan environment. They're going to have logistical challenges that are, you know, that we don't have to the same degree. But I mean, I know there's some really sharp, cool people involved in that, and I'm sure it's going to like be successful. I think partly what's hard, again, is kind of, you know, defining what you do and what you don't do, because you don't want to be, you know, you don't want to limit yourself, you know, place limitations on your program that prevent you from being effective. You also, you know, you can't do everything. You can't have just some sprawling scope of practice, especially when you're just getting off the ground or when you have a limited service area, that kind of thing. You know, part of the problem with the Eugene program, I think one of the things we're struggling with a lot is we're getting too many calls from concerned citizens that are basically, you know, people joke about like, you know, the Karens or whatever, you know, too many calls from people that, you know, basically like, oh, I saw a guy pushing a shopping cart and yelling obscenities, send Cahoots to do something. And then it's like, okay, well, what's the likelihood Cahoots is going to even find this person? What's the likelihood this person's going to want anything from Cahoots? So I feel like there's a lot of calls that are being made without a lot of intention, you know, with just this assumption that we can, you know, have some amazing things to offer people that are going to fix their lives or something. And it's kind of uninformed. And I can imagine in Portland right now, I mean, just like the homelessness becomes more, the homeless crisis worsens. There's gonna be a lot of people thinking like, oh, well, I don't want to call the police, but I also maybe I don't want this person sleeping on my lawn. So I'm gonna call this agency thinking that I'm doing something, but not really putting a lot of thought into what that's really going to accomplish.
They're called unwanted person calls.
Right. And so, yeah, do you want to respond to a million of those a day? I don't think that's really where our strength is. And that all speaks to problems that are really big that we're not the antidote for.
Another issue Commissioner Hardesty found out when she visited 911 was that sometimes they didn't know who to send. So they sent everyone, the police, the fire department, medical. Do you have that issue in Eugene?
Yeah, it's everywhere, and it's obnoxious, and it's comical. And, you know, especially when you know, in any city, you know, every city has a budget crisis, right? Everybody's like, oh, we don't have enough money to pay for this and that and the other thing. But then it's like, okay, well, somebody could literally be like sleeping in a field and you just sent like 15 responders, you know, like, so give me a break. But yeah, so there's, you know, that's part of the problem, I think, is just this overkill response to situations that's just wasteful and unnecessary and unhelpful. And, but, you know, part of, you know, one of our things like in Eugene is that like we respond to a lot of man down calls. And which, you know, you hear a call that's like, oh, there's a person laying on the sidewalk or laying in a field or laying on someone's lawn or whatever. And they're it's unknown if they're conscious and breathing. Sounds like, oh, that sounds really intense or something. But it's like why they send us those calls is like statistically those people are sleeping, intoxicated. Most of the time, they're not having a medical emergency. Most of the time, they're not either the victims or perpetrators of a serious crime. So they send us those calls most of the time. Problem is, I mean, you know, 1 out of 100 of those calls is something more serious. You know, that's just the price you pay. Every once in a while, I mean, I had one a few months ago, check on a woman in a parking lot. We get there, I mean, she's basically frozen. She dies on the way to the hospital. I mean, that happens. But it's always going to be a flawed kind of system, but you have to kind of hone it to serve the most people as well as possible.
My guest has been Brenton Gicker, registered nurse and emergency medical technician with Cahoots in Eugene, Oregon. Brenton, thank you so much and all the best with Cahoots this wonderful program that you've been a part of for so many years. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Radio Zine programs at kboo.fm/radiozine. Thank you to our engineers, and thank you to you, our listeners, with a reminder that KBOO is community supported, and we ask just a few times a year to show your support for independent radio. You tuned in right now because you appreciate KBOO's AM public affairs programming. So please show your support right now during KBOO's spring membership drive. There are several ways you can give: online at kboo.fm/give, in the mobile app by clicking donate. You can text KBOO to 44-321 or snail mail to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Thank you for listening, and thank you for giving. Thank you.
have some gravy in your ear. This is Wavy Gravy, Temple of Accumulated Error and Voice of Woodstock, telling you you are listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM. The 90s are the 60s, standing on your head.